This is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. Yeah, stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
It's 8:06. I'm Katie Hyde from the Michigan Talk Network, filling in on the Steve Gruber Show this week. And before that long break, we were talking to Herb London. He's the president of the London Center for Policy Research, and he was kind enough to wait through that long break. And Herb, welcome back to the program.
Well, happy to wait.
You were mentioning before the break about metadata. This is a key term that we heard last night in the debates. Can you tell us what it is and what it isn't?
Well, it's the collection of all of the telephone calls and all of the communications that occur nationwide. Again, I wouldn't know that you made the telephone call. All I have is all of these numbers that are listed. And then what I would attempt to do is try to put together an algorithm that would suggest Party A is calling someone in Yemen on a regular basis, and the person in Yemen turns out to be someone who has ties to terrorists. And the more information of that kind I can obtain, the more likely it is that I can not only trace the terrorist network, but in fact do something to monitor what. This kind of metadata allows you to not only penetrate the terrorist network, but allows you to go over that historical period. You can start to see trend lines. In the past, you were permitted to do this over a five-year period. Now the NSA can only do it over a year-and-a-half period. So we've cut back dramatically. I'm not sure that's a good idea. When we consider the fact that we have terrorists who are in the United States at the moment, we know that the FBI has said there are at least 900 that we are tracking that are ISIS sleepers here in the United States. We have to do everything in our power to make sure that they do not launch an attack. And one of the ways to do that is to monitor these telephone calls. Now, the civil libertarians, of course I am one as well, would say, look, we do not want to interfere with privacy. But what they do not understand is that when you have all of this metadata, I can't specifically say Katie is calling someone on the 15th of the month or the 17th of the month. I don't know that. All I have is all of this data. Then I start to see patterns in the data, and when I get patterns in the data, that is when I try to see whether, in fact, there are ties to terrorist networks.
I think that's so important that's what you mentioned, because I think that's what a lot of Americans are saying. Like, these are my private thoughts. These are my private calls. I don't want something embarrassing that I sent to my boyfriend or girlfriend or husband or wife or whatever. Although if they track my phone, they'd find all these texts to my husband. It's your turn to get the kids.
But I mean, I understand the concern, and I understand that there is a kind of alarmist view that now the government is acting like Big Brother. And we've got an Orwellian situation on our hands where the government is now insinuated into every aspect of our lives. Well, that's not what megadata is all about. If you were to see all of these numbers, they wouldn't make sense to you at all. And you wouldn't be able to say, oh, that's my friend Joan, that's my friend Mary. You wouldn't be able to do that. There's absolutely no way you could do that. But as I said, if you are clever enough and you start to see patterns and you understand the algorithms that are now imposed by the intelligence community, then you understand how we manage to track these terrorist organizations. When Donald Trump said last night, well, we've got to shut down the internet and then we'll penetrate, you know, we start infiltrating. Well, that's silly. We're not going to shut down the internet. But we should be in the position of knowing enough about internet connections so that we can start to see patterns. And as a result of those patterns, we can start monitoring the affairs of people who want to do harm to the United States.
Well, it sounds like metadata is a huge piece for defeating ISIS. I had a guest on earlier this week that says it's not if, but it's when we defeat ISIS. He's not obviously sure of when we will do that, but he says afterwards, we need to have a plan in place about what we do over there. We can't just pull out and leave. What are your ideas about what should be in place after ISIS is defeated?
Well, look, ISIS, we're fighting against ISIS. We're fighting against RAF. If ISIS is defeated, there will be some other radical group. Keep in mind, we have been at war with al-Nusra. We have been at war with al-Qaeda. We have been at war with the Muslim Brotherhood. Now we're fighting the ISIS. I mean, what you're going to find radical Islamic groups. What we have to do is to understand what it is and who it is we're fighting against. The important thing to understand is that, as President al-Sisi of Egypt said, when he made his courageous speech at Al-Azhar, which is the center of theological thought in the Sunni world, he said, there is a violence from within our religion. We've got to cope with it. And he said at the end of his speech, we need a revolution from within. When that speech was given, this was like Martin Luther speaking to the Catholic Church. We should have said at that moment, this is important. This is extraordinary. We have an ally that wants to deal with this issue. Not all Muslims are violent. But there is a violence within the religion that has to be dealt with. And there are people like al-Sisi who want to do so. They're our allies. These are people who we should count on. That speech should have been plastered in every single newspaper and in every media organ in the United States. It's among the most important speeches given in the last 100 years and received scant attention in the United States. If I were to ask you about it and say, Katie, tell me what was in that speech, you would be hard-pressed to do so.
Agreed.
And yet it was as important as any speech that's been given over the last 100 years, and my feeling is this country knows little about it because we have to find allies in that part of the world who want to deal with this whole question of why is there violence within this religion? Why is there an imperial dimension to this religion? Why is there a desire to use the religion, use the violence within the religion to expand its scope? These are questions that can only be answered by people within the Muslim faith. And as I said, not every Muslim is violent, but there is a violence within the religion that has to be dealt with.
I think you make a good point. I have friends who were born here. They're working over in Kenya now, and they said that same thing about our media. They said, you are not covering the things that we're hearing over here, and that Egypt speech was one of them.
Well, I happened to meet President Sisi. And I must say that he's a very impressive guy. Now, it's true that there has been a shutdown of many of the journalistic organs in the country. And he's fighting a war internally against the Muslim Brotherhood, and they have a big bullseye on his back. But at the same time, it's important to understand that he is a potential ally in this war against radical Islam. We have to find allies of that kind. The King of Bahrain, after the speech was given by al-Sisi, said the same thing. And, of course, the King of Jordan has been saying the same thing. Why isn't the American public aware of that? Why aren't these people elevated to positions of real authority? And we say, you know something, these are the voices we want to hear from. It's not merely the radicals we want to hear from. It's not the Baghdadis, who is, of course, the leader of ISIS. We want to hear from those people who represent voices of interest and reason within this community.
Well,
who are doing something about the extremism within the religion.
Herb, we are so thankful that you have brought that to our attention. Herb London, he's president of the London Center for Policy Research. Thank you so much for hanging out with us this morning.
Pleasure to be with you. All the best to you. And happy and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, too. It's 14 after the hour. I'm Katie Hyde filling in on The Steve Gruber Show.
The Steve Gruber Show. American values with Midwestern common sense.
Good morning. It's 18 after the hour. I'm Katie Hyde from the Michigan Talk Network filling in for Steve all this week. He'll be back Monday morning in the seat, and you have to give him a good report when he is. It's been great being with you all this week. We're going to keep the program moving along. Aaron Call, who is the Director of Debate from the University of Michigan, joins us on the line. Aaron, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
What was your overall impression of the debate last night?
Yeah, I thought it was a little less dramatic than kind of talked about going in. You know, some people expected fireworks between Trump and Cruz, and that didn't materialize. But we did get some some good combative debate between Jeb Bush and Trump, and then Cruz and Rubio, and I thought those debates were spirited and had some moments during the middle, but overall, I think that didn't affect the kind of trajectory of the race. I think things will be pretty similar to the status quo as we proceed to 2016 in the next debate in South Carolina.
So it didn't change a lot of things, is what you're saying.
No, I don't think so. You know, Trump was the consensus frontrunner going in, and he had some great polls that came out leading up to the debate, and I don't think that's going to change. I think he stumbled a bit early with that Bush. Governor Bush really got the better of him in the earlier portion of the debate, but Trump was able to take the punches and rebound, and I thought closed pretty solidly. The kind of eliminating the third-party candidacy, I thought, was a good way to end the debate. And because this was the first debate that Cruz and Rubio really spent a lot of time bloodying each other, that's something that's going to be good for the frontrunner when the number two and number three candidates both damage each other. That's always good for who's winning the race.
Right. I thought Marco Rubio made some great headway last night. Did you think that anybody else stood out, or would you have liked to have heard more from some other candidates that maybe didn't get as much talking time?
I do think Rubio had another good performance. The last few debates had been very solid, and since the topic of this one was almost exclusively foreign policy and national security, he was able to use his experience in Senate and in committees that deal with those issues effectively. Although I will say, in this debate, it's the first time that he was really challenged effectively by another top-tier candidate. So I think Cruz definitely did land some punches. And immigration reform and Rubio's part of the Gang of Eight, that received a significant amount of time. Chris Christie, I think, had helped himself, had another good night. The topic of the debate helped him, being the only former federal prosecutor. I thought that he started a little bit slow talking about Los Angeles, but as the debate went on, was pretty strong. In terms of not having enough time, I think that Governor Kasich and Carly Fiorina both had pretty solid performances. I think everyone overall did well. Just with that many candidates on stage, just the timing to be able to get to hear enough from those lower tier candidates, it's just really tough, and certainly something not that I don't envy as Wolf Blitzer and the moderators. It's a tough job.
Oh, no. And another guest previously on the program today said it's too many people to have on stage at a time to effectively do something. Now, do you think that there's any candidate up there where you say, hey, the writing's on the wall, your campaign is fizzling, it's going to be done?
Yeah, I think that Rand Paul is probably the closest. He barely made the main stage this time, and with some favorable math by CNN in the last minute, they was the only thing that got him on stage. And I think his campaign had even hinted that if he didn't make the main stage in this last debate, that he may suspend his campaign. So I think he's the one that looks more vulnerable. But we've got another month till the next debate in January. And for a lot of these candidates, there's just not a lot of incentive to leave the stage if if they have enough money. They're willing to kind of ride it out, at least until votes starting to get cast in February.
Right. One of the things that Carly Fiorina was saying last night, and I was hoping to hear more from her, but she said the private sector needs to get involved with the government to help them defeat ISIS and track them down and work together. What's your takeaway from that?
Yeah, she was solid, and you could tell that really wanted to and had to even get the moderator to say, hey, what about, me on the question of ISIS? That was one of the major topics of the night. That was, I think, her strongest thing, the private sector experience, playing yourself as an outsider, reminding people about the dissatisfaction with Washington and, career typical politicians. But her point about, getting former generals involved to the process and, mentioning several by names, she talked about up her connections in the world, and even though she didn't have the government experience, so kind of what it was like to be a
major CEO after 9/11 and the kind of skill set that's required that could really be really beneficial for a president to have. So, no, I think she had another strong performance, but it's just, you know, when you're that far down in the polls, just at a few percentage points, unless you do something exceptional or there's a major event in the debate, it doesn't seem like she'll be able to get enough traction. She's always been well in the debate stage, but then in the interim on the campaign trail, not been able to replicate that success and get the media attention and coverage when she's not on the stage. And there's just too much time in between the debates and not enough debates to really probably propel her up to that top tier.
Aaron, we have about 10 seconds. Can you give me your impressions of Ben Carson?
Was a little bit more credible in foreign policy. I thought he was the trip overseas, everything really helped. He started out a little bit slow, but I thought finished pretty strong and didn't hurt himself and had an okay and solid performance.
Excellent. Thank you for your response. You do so much better than the folks on the debate. They hear that bell ring and they keep talking, but you filled the time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Aaron Call from the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for joining us. It's 8:25. I'm Katie Hyde filling in on the Steve Gruber Show.
Genuine Michigan common sense on display every day.
Sheepdog, standing in the rain. Bullfrog, doing it again. Some kind of happiness is measured out in miles. What makes you think you're something special when you smile?
Good morning. It's 8:33. You're listening to Katie Hyde. I'm from the Michigan Talk Network. I'm filling in for Steve Gruber all this week on the Steve Gruber Show. And this hour is brought to you by Mesa, good health, good business, and great schools. And we have had a great show today. And we've been talking a lot about the Republican debates that took place last night in Las Vegas. And we're always curious to hear what your takeaway from that is. I was sitting there watching it. I was emailing our producer. I was taking notes and I had a lot going on, but I'm just one person with one opinion and some conclusions of my own, but I would love to hear from you. This is your show and we want to hear your thoughts. Our number is 888-900-9966. Again, that number is 888-900-9966. And we would love to hear your thoughts on the debate or anything else you want to share. It's not a free-for-all Friday yet, but I'm feeling a little wild and crazy here on this Wednesday. I'm feeling a little more comfortable behind the mic. So Steve's going to be sorry by the time Friday comes. They gave me, carte blanche to kind of take over the airwaves. No, I'm just kidding. I'll make sure Steve's show is intact when he gets back here on Monday. But a lot of things that we saw on the debate stage last night. It's the last time we'll see the candidates all together in 2015. And then the next debate will be about mid-January. It's going to be hosted by Fox News. And so obviously you have two different perspectives. You have CNN, which has this very liberal leaning, and then you have Fox News, which has this very conservative leaning. And it will be interesting to know how that all goes down. Well, joining me on the line, we have our guest for the program. We have Arlen Meekoff. He is on the line with us, and he is here to talk to us about some Michigan politics. So, Senator, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. Good morning.
Yes, thank you for joining us. Now, can you give me a rundown of some of the big things that have happened in the Michigan Senate this year?
Sure. First would be the road funding plan. Some sort of ability for us to continue to invest in our roads and infrastructure. That's an issue that's probably eluded us for 15 to 20 years. We've made a really, really good start on that. We funded earlier in the year, most people forget about this, when we funded in the budget a lot of money to eliminate the backlog of all the rape kits, over 100,000 or 10,000 rape kits that were on backlog, and so they could start prosecuting offenders, and that's really worked out well. And in this budget, as we started right now, most people also didn't remember that we prioritized about $500 million of general fund money to roads, to additional infrastructure. So we've done a number of things that I think are good government things And we're anxious and ready to get into the second year and do some more.
We're on the line with Michigan Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhoff. And is there anything that you didn't get done? We're running out of time here in 2015, but is there anything that you didn't get done that you wish you had?
Well, there's a couple things out there that are big policy things that are will have many issues to debate, and that would be where are we going to land on our energy policy for the state, and we're still wrestling with that. Again, implications for 20, 30 years, the type of policy that we've put together there. And we got a lot of work to do on Detroit Public Schools yet. We just haven't found the right spot to help give the opportunity to students to help improve their education. And to me, it's most importantly that they have the opportunity to get a great education so they can be in line to be eligible for those great new jobs that are being created in Detroit. And I think that's the top of the list for me in terms of Detroit Public Schools.
That's right. And you mentioned the energy policy, and DTE and Consumers Energy has announced, you know, they're shuttering some coal plants. And so obviously that is going to play into this, isn't it, in 2016?
Yeah. Many people early on were predicting we were going to have an energy shortage immediately. Well, that's not necessarily true. It could be a number of years out. But you know, there's also some things we could do with efficiency. There are other energy generating folks besides DTE and Consumers that maybe we in the free market we'd be able to add to their ability to generate energy at a very inexpensive cost. But and then we also have to look at if we're going to build a big power plant in Michigan, how is it competitively bid? Who's eligible to bid on? Some things like that. So we have a lot of work to do on that yet.
Looking ahead to 2016, what else is on the table? What else can we expect, Senator?
Well, again, we'll work really, really hard on the budget, which is the first part of the year. The governor, I think, has already set his state address in mid-January, the 19th, I believe. So it'll be Detroit Public Schools, energy policy, and then our caucus is really interested in corrections reform and cost of those corrections, and why are we so much higher than our neighboring states, and how can we do better and lower our recidivism rate so we have lower costs going forward. Senator Prose is our point on that, and he's got some great ideas that we need to flesh out a little bit, and so it's good governance is what we're trying to do.
All right, so Michiganders should be encouraged then is what you're saying.
I certainly hope so, and I hope your listeners all have a great holidays with their family. We tend to think of that more at this time of year, although we should think of our families all year round, but we usually get together with them around the holidays and enjoy that time. So I hope your listeners' families do as well.
Well, I appreciate that, and I have a question. It's a little more personal in nature. I hope you don't mind, but my understanding is you can't run again because of term limits. Do you have any plans afterwards?
I've been making jokes about this because some few people have asked me, and I said, look, I've made it to 56 years old, and I haven't had to grow up yet, so I just think that I don't have to. So I don't really know what I want to be when I grow up. I'm certainly enjoying this job, and I want to be the most effective leader I can to help my colleagues get their legislative agendas done so we can keep continuing to improve Michigan and make it better for our kids and our grandkids, leave it a better place when we're done.
Well, we appreciate you being on the show. It's Michigan Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhoff. Thank you so much. And I'm hosting this week, but I'm probably not going to talk to you before the holidays. So I wish you and your family a very Merry Christmas.
Wow, thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You as well.
Thank you. All right. So a lot to say there from Michigan Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhoff talking about what the state has done and what they're planning on doing in 2016. And so a lot going on. But of course, we'll be taking some time off for the holidays and things like that. So it's 8:40. This hour is brought to you by Mesa, good health, good business, and great schools. I'm Katie Hyde from the Michigan Talk Network, filling in for Steve all this week. And we're going to close out the show after this break. We're going to be speaking with Dr. Ann Speckard. She is a world-renowned expert on the psychology of terrorism. The topic is when mothers kill and die to attain martyrdom status. And if you'll remember, after the San Bernardino shootings, 27-year-old Tashin Malik, who was the wife of Saeed Farouk, who was the female half, or excuse me, Tashin Malik is the female half of the California mass murder, that there were some things floating out there about her, including, you know, why would a mother go this route? What would convince her to do that? And also some ridiculous thoughts on the fact that this woman was experiencing postpartum depression. But we will get to that when we talk to Dr. Ann Speckard right here after this break. So it's 8:41. Katie Hyde from the Michigan Talk Network. I'm filling in for Steve Gruber all this week on the Steve Gruber Show. Stick around. You'll want to hear our next segment.
Keeping you in touch with Michigan and the world.
I gotta get down. I gotta get down. Gotta get down to
Welcome back to the Steve Gruber Show. It's 15 before the hour. I'm Katie Hyde from the Michigan Talk Network, filling in for Steve Gruber all this week. And as I've been saying all along, this is your program, and I'm inviting you to call in. The number's 888-900-9966. And we have Philip from Flint on the line. Philip, welcome to the program.
Good morning, ma'am.
Good morning. What do you have on your mind?
Well, you know, the questions, a lot of them were leading. They got the candidates to fight amongst each other, or at least pick on each other in different ways. They all said things they wanted to do, but in all honesty, the country's broke. I mean, more than 25% of every dollar everyone pays in taxes now is just servicing debt. Until we get our economy going, it isn't going to get us much of anywhere. You don't have any money to buy these new submarines, new airplanes, and new missiles, and all these new servicemen they want, because we're broke. You can't borrow that money from China and then turn around and get China to represent us and take us as from a sign of strength to help us with other problems.
Absolutely, Philip.
It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, and I think that you're reflecting a lot of what other people are saying. That's fair enough. So, Philip, on the line from Flint, thank you so much for your thoughts. We're going to shift gears over here. I have with me on the line Dr. Ann Speckard. She's an expert on the psychology of terrorism. And, Doctor, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Katie. Nice to talk with you.
Nice to talk with you, too. Help me understand Tashfeen Malik. Help me understand this woman and others like her.
Okay, well, Tashfeen, as we know, was raised in Pakistan, and there's hotbeds of fanatic activity in Pakistan, so she may have been radicalized over there, or she may have been radicalized, as other Americans have, on the Internet. And we know that one of the ways that ISIS is penetrating our national border is straight through the cable and phone lines through Internet. They put out thousands of materials every day, and they try to capture the imaginations of people that are unhappy and tell them that they can propose an alternative world order, and in that world order, they will deliver a utopia. And sorry, but it's going to take some violence to get there, and we need you.
And when we talk about the psychology of terrorism, I see these women, from my perspective, as an oppressed group anyways, and so if a male is going to come to them, or ISIS, or an authority figure, or whatever it is, and say, this is what you have to do, they're probably more likely to follow than someone from the West.
No, the conservative Islamic group, some of them have used women right from the beginning. The Chechens used them, so they were suicide bombers right from the beginning, and they represented 50-50. But Palestinians didn't use women until they couldn't get their men to cross the checkpoints. Women are advantage to a terrorist group because they can hide things on their bodies more easily. They garner trust more easily, because we do have a myth that women aren't violent, when in fact some women are violent. But when women are put forward as terrorists, they usually volunteer themselves. They're not usually forced, at least what we've seen recently. Although we did see the Iraqis used two mentally handicapped women, so, you know, they were preyed upon. That was Al-Qaeda in Iraq 1.0 before ISIS. And we have seen now the marriage certificate in ISIS says that al-Baghdadi can give permission. So that means that a woman doesn't have to subserviently ask her husband. If she wants to go as a suicide bomber, she can get permission from the so-called caliph. And we do have a report of one woman being approached in Raqqa and being asked if she would go as a woman. But ISIS, as a bomber, but ISIS on its own territory really wants the women to be wives because they don't have enough women to go around for their fighters, and they're very actively recruiting women to come as wives. But these people made their own ISIS-inspired idea. And once they bought into the poison Kool-Aid, they drank the poison Kool-Aid, it overrode everything else. So the maternal instincts overrode, the paternal instinct, the self-preservation instinct, and basically they're such true believers, in quotes, that they think they're going to paradise when they kill and die.
Well, and she'd have to be to leave her six-month-old baby behind. Now, that's a powerful stranglehold that they would have on these people. How do we combat this?
Well, right now I'm working on a project where we're interviewing defectors from ISIS. And short of a political solution that we bring stability to Syria and Iraq, and as your previous caller rightly said, we don't have the resources to do that. We've got a lot of debt, and, you know, we just don't have limitless resources and lives to spare over there. So it's unlikely that we're going to see a political solution quickly. So then what we have to do is we have to discredit the group and its claims. And I can't think of any stronger voice than people that have been on the inside, defectors, to speak against them. And the things that we're hearing from the people we're interviewing are absolutely amazing. How they take 10-year-old kids and try to talk them into going inside rigged-up cars with suicide apparatus and drive them at high speeds into enemy lines and tell the kids, you won't feel any pain, you'll go straight to paradise. I mean, a 10-year-old doesn't have the cognitive abilities to, you know, figure out that the adult is telling them a pile of garbage.
Well, it sounds like you have your work cut out for you, and we appreciate you for your work. Dr. Ann Speckard, an expert on the psychology of terrorism, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
You're welcome, Katie.
That's going to be it for this edition of the Steve Gruber Show. We're going to wrap it up here in the next couple of minutes, but I want to thank our guest for being with us. A lot to consider. This isn't a one-size-fits-all solution. She gave us a lot to think about. You're listening to Katie Hyde from the Michigan Talk Network on the Steve Gruber Show.